Hello, and welcome to Korean Context. My name is Nicholas Hamasevich, Director of Research and Academic Affairs at KEI, and I will be your host today. In this episode, we talk with Dr. Yagadeesan Sami on income inequality in South Korea and its effect on Korea's economy. Dr. Sami is an economist and an associate professor at Carleton University in Ottawa, Canada. He is also a distinguished research associate at the North-South Institute. Dr. Sami has written an academic paper series report for KEI on income inequality, and he has done previous work looking at income inequality in other countries. Before this research on South Korea, he was examining income inequality in Brazil. In your academic paper series report you've written for us, you mentioned that often inequality of income tends to be associated with unequal access to other factors conducive to development, like education or healthcare, perceptions about government efficiency, corruption, political stability, all these kind of other issues, rather than just straight up the income of particular people or particular individuals and groups. Do you think that it is these associations with unequal access to these types of issues that make income inequality more of a political issue for countries like the United States and South Korea?
Yes, I'm pretty sure that it's part of the explanation. There is a perception that left on its own, the market will not deliver what people expect to get. Most people will argue that they are not being given enough opportunities. I'm not so sure about the South Korean context, but certainly in other contexts, it's difficult to make a case that inequality of income is simply a reflection of what the market is saying it should be. So what I mean by this is that, you know, if you look at the whole distribution of income, it's pretty difficult to make a case that it's a perfect reflection of what the market dictates. Some of it is a reflection of a market, but some of it could also be a result of lack of access to essential things like health and education. And this is where I think redistribution has a role to play.
In the event, you talked about how, in general, or just looking at the numbers, South Korea doesn't seem to have as big of an income inequality gap that other countries have. How interesting is that to you, and why do you think South Korea is an interesting case with income inequality if it's not as big as these other countries that are dealing with income inequality as well?
South Korea is an interesting case partly because it has gone through structural changes. So the economy has shifted from agriculture to manufacturing / industry to services over a fairly short period of time, 40, 50 years. The change has been very positive, and I think it's a very interesting case to look at because, as you mentioned, even though inequality is relatively low, people are talking about it. And the reason we are talking about it is not necessarily because they look at the absolute value. It's because we are looking at its evolution over time. And I think this is why looking at a case over time is very helpful. So essentially, people are not necessarily focused on a particular number. They are more interested in its evolution. And the thing with inequality is that South Koreans will not compare themselves to Americans or Canadians. They will compare themselves to other South Koreans. And if they see that this is changing over time, then it's not surprising that it becomes part of a conversation. So yes, if you compare across countries, South Korea is not as unequal as others in Latin America, for instance, but it is still a place where people are worried about the middle class shrinking, and partly because they've been used to a different scenario in the past. So if you look at the data, you're starting to see inequality going up, albeit from a fairly low level, but it is increasing, right? And people are talking more about it.
Right.
So from an academic perspective, it's interesting because it shows that even though the absolute number may be low, what people are more interested in is how that number is changing over time. So when you are used to a system, or when you're used over time to having fairly equal distributions of income, even minor changes in that distribution will actually start a conversation or a concern about it.
It's interesting, in your paper you have Korea's income inequality increasing and then decreasing, and now it's coming back to the increasing. So because it happened in a short period of time, is there a way to have that conversation about, hey, we had this issue before and we were able to get through it? Or are the dynamics now just too different to kind of compare income inequality now to income inequality numbers before?
The dynamics are clearly different. Korean, South Korean society has evolved more and more towards a service-oriented economy. And maybe this evolution implies that you have to quote-unquote pay a price in terms of higher inequality. If you believe the hypothesis and the results of a paper, what I am arguing essentially is that structural changes are bound to lead to these swings up and down in inequality, and that ultimately this is something that societies may or may not choose to deal with. In the South Korean case, it's not as extreme as we have seen in other places yet. But I think if this trend continues, policymakers, the government, will have to address it. So for me, as long as they are aware beforehand of the implications of structural changes for inequality, it's a first step in the right direction. Because I think recognizing that this is a problem, to me, is the first step, really. And afterwards, it's a question of how you go about dealing with it. There, the politics will come into play. The question will be, can we accept it? And I think future work should be able to show, or at least demonstrate, that a certain level of inequality is okay. But if it goes too high, then maybe it's not as good, because it may affect growth. Having said that, I don't necessarily think that you cannot have policies where you are dealing with inequality and growth at the same time. So you could think of situations where you're trying to improve the distribution of income without necessarily suffering lower growth as a result. So these two things don't necessarily go in opposite directions. You could think of interventions where you're redistributing and yet you're not hurting growth.
And so that was one of the other interesting things you're talking about in the paper and in the literature, where you can have some income inequality and growth, but you also can't have too much income inequality. There is some literature that says it starts to impact your growth abilities. So can you just talk about that a little bit more, where there is that kind of range that you're okay, yeah, but once you get past that, it's going to start impacting everything else?
In the South Korean case, I don't think we have enough evidence that shows that inequality has had a negative impact on growth.
Okay.
It's a country where growth rates are still very high, except for the last few years. But the last few years, we've had a financial crisis. But even a 4% growth rate in that context is actually quite strong. Over the long term, 6-7% on average, closer to 7%, I think. So I don't think we can say with a limited data, limited time window that we have, that inequality has had a negative impact on growth. At least from the data that I've looked at, I don't see it. Of course, in the future, if inequality keeps increasing, it may end up having a larger impact. I don't think it's something I would certainly be worried about. Having said that, it doesn't mean that we don't have to address income inequality. I think, you know, there will be political pressure to address it. That's very common in most societies, and I don't think South Korea is an exception in that regard.
One of the factors listed as a possible reason for rising inequality in South Korea is the dualistic labor markets. Could you explain kind of a little bit about dualistic labor markets and where this might be seen as impacting the South Korean economy, specifically toward income inequality?
My understanding of a dualistic labor market in the South Korean case is that labor market reforms that were conducted have produced a difference by putting basically workers into two separate categories. On the one hand, you have people who are regularly employed. They have predetermined contract with their employers. Their incomes are pretty much guaranteed, so it's a standard contract situation. And then, because of the reforms, you also have people who became what is known as irregularly employed. So these are people who are hired on unlimited term appointments. Sometimes it could be part-time. So as a result of this, of these market reforms, you have a labor market which is no longer homogeneous. So you have two separate types of workers with very different contractual relationships. And that's basically your dualistic labor market story. And what ends up happening is that the ones who have a standard contract will tend to have wages that are guaranteed. There's not a lot of dispersion in those wages, whereas the ones who are in the sector where they don't have standard contracts will have very different wages. So as a result of this, you have a larger distribution in your wages. And that's how, in the literature, some people have pointed out that this type of dualistic labor market situation has actually enlarged the wage distribution across a particular sector, or probably more in the service sector than in the manufacturing sector. And as a result of this, you can see the link between dualistic labor markets on the one hand and income inequality on the other.
Trade is such a big part of Korea's economy. How do you see trade looking at income inequality?
For a long time, the trade situation in South Korea led to a decline in income inequality. If you look at other studies, or even if you look at the theory behind this, this is the result that you would have expected to see. So as South Korea liberalized, produced and exported goods that used its abundant factor, labor, you would have expected to see labor gain as a result of this, reducing the gap between labor owners and capital owners, or even reducing the gap between unskilled and skilled labor. So this is the textbook story. And for a long time, I think that trade story tended to fit well with the Korean data. So it's not a surprise. What is surprising now is the fact that even though Korea has increasingly globalized over time, whether you look at trade or foreign direct investment, so as the country became more and more globalized, now inequality is increasing. So clearly, the trade explanation is no longer sufficient. Now, you can rescue that trade explanation if you make a case that perhaps South Korea is no longer labor abundant, or perhaps it is no longer unskilled labor abundant. And by doing that, you can rescue the trade story, but I don't think you can rescue it completely. So there must be something else going on. Now, where the paper that I've written fits with this is the extent to which trade, or FDI, or globalization more broadly, helps us understand changes in the structure of countries' economies. So to the extent that globalization through trade or FDI affected the structure of the Korean economy, it would have an indirect implication for income inequality. In the estimates that we conducted, we can see that trade is in fact not significant, but foreign direct investment is significant. Now, it could well be that these estimates are not telling us the full story because they don't really explore that link between trade and the structure of the economy. So I would argue that trade and FDI probably play a role in this, and they play a role in terms of affecting the structure of the economy. I always give the example of, you know, if a country is trading with the rest of the world and it's opened its economy, that is bound to change as efficiency kicks in. So some industries will survive, others won't, because you can no longer compete with low-cost producers, for instance. And as a result of this, that's going to have a major impact on the structure of the economy. So certainly, if you follow that logic, trade or foreign direct investment will have an impact on income inequality. And the South Korean case may not be that different in the end from other countries that have also liberalized and become more and more global.
I think that's such an interesting point that Korea is going to be an interesting case for the rest of the world. And you kind of point this out in your paper. Korea is trying to promote its development model and promote how it became an economic success story. And so for you, how do you think Korea should look at or talk about its income inequality trends and how it's trying to deal with income inequality as part of its development model when it's talking to other countries about these processes and these developments?
My own view is that South Koreans or policymakers, the government, should talk about income inequality as part of a development process. As countries go through various transitions, the distribution of income will change. And one way to maybe make a case for this is that South Korea is, after all, not very different from other advanced societies that are also in the high-income categories, such as Canada or the U.S. These are countries that have also seen inequality go up, decline, and then go back up. And these cycles will continue as long as you see major structural changes. So that would be, for me, the first step, really, is to accept the fact that income inequality is part of development, is part of a society's evolution. And then the second step is to look at measures where needed to redistribute or maybe to mitigate the large increases in income inequality. I don't think South Korea is there yet. Its income distribution is certainly not extreme. But if in the years to come, there's a perception among the public and policymakers that this is not sustainable and that the middle class is getting smaller, it's getting too small, or that service sector jobs, for instance, are not paying high enough incomes, there's a need then to rethink the approach to continued development.
Okay.
So at the end, in my paper, I talk about the dynamism and productivity of the service sector, for instance, and how we should start thinking about making that sector even more productive, more dynamic, or moving more and more towards higher value-added services, or making sure, for instance, that the manufacturing sector continues to generate jobs that are providing sufficient incomes to people. So there's a whole range of issues, I think, that this will lead to. But certainly, I think South Korea should continue to be proud of its accomplishments. I mean, what you see really is a very good example of how countries can transform themselves over time. And the interesting thing in this case is that even though inequality has gone up and down over that period, growth has kept increasing. And I think this is something that we need to be recognize, that growth can go hand in hand with both increasing and decreasing inequality. And in fact, in the paper, we make a case that growth can also hand in hand with both industrialization and deindustrialization. Because in the South Korean case, you can clearly see this at work. Growth has been positive for most of South Korea's 40, 50 years, in the last 40, 50 years, and yet we have seen structural changes. So I think this is actually a very interesting case to look at. And I would also add that there are probably interesting lessons for countries who are in the middle or low income category who are now looking at South Korea as a successful example, because they will also have to deal with changes in income inequality as they continue to climb the development ladder.
So you said South Korea might not be there yet, but what are some of the, in general, what are some of the tools a government can use to help alleviate income inequality?
The obvious one is redistribution, tax policy, and redistribution policy. So in one of the interesting findings from the research that we did is when we compare South Korea to other high-income countries, all the OECD countries, South Korea has both one of the lowest tax to GDP ratios and also lowest spending in social sectors. So the first thing would be to look at both sides of this coin, namely the taxation side and the spending side, because one cannot go without the other. So I think this is one key aspect that redistribution will need to take into consideration. How do you improve the efficiency of tax collection, and then where do you prioritize that spending? I hope that this paper also convinces people that, you know, part of it is really the structure. So redistribution can only help to a certain extent, but changes in the structure of your economy will probably become more and more strong. So you cannot rely completely on a redistribution strategy. You need to keep growing. You need to keep finding ways to innovate, to do things better, to become more efficient. Because at the end of the day, this is what allows you to have a bigger pie. It allows you to have a bigger economy. And that also allows you to have better redistribution. So while I favor having a look at tax and redistribution policies, I'm not in any way saying that we should not focus on growth. In fact, growth has to be the continued focus, because without growth, you will never be able to redistribute. So growth has to remain the most important factor. And after that, you can think about ways in which you can redistribute. And to get more into the sort of nitty-gritty of this, I mean, if you think about things like aging populations, for instance, in South Korea, which is going to be a problem in the future. So these demographic shifts, which can also have an impact on income inequality, can be managed. So in many rich countries, there's discussions about pension reforms. There's been discussions about extending retirement age. So these are more specific policies, and I think that once you get past redistribution or past growth, you know, there are certainly more micro policies that can be applied or can be at least given some thought.
Are there ways to narrow inequality without government intervention?
That's an interesting question, actually. I think, you know, sometimes inequality may, simply because of the evolution of society, decline. Now, if you follow the logic of what the paper is trying to do, it's arguing that every time you have a major structural shift, inequality will move in cycles. So right now, inequality is rising, but you can imagine maybe further down the road in 10, 15 years, if there's a major structural change, that it can go down again. So without any intervention, it is possible, at least in theory, to think about cases where future structural changes might reverse that trend. But over the short to medium term, I just don't see how you can rely completely on these structural changes, because if you just follow the logic of what the paper is describing, without any government intervention, and if it's just a question of structural changes, inequality will increase. So you need government intervention. But again, I want to be very careful about this, because you need government intervention if you think that the level of income inequality right now is not appropriate. But this is a political issue. It's a political decision at the end of the day for policymakers to decide whether they think the current levels of income inequality are acceptable or not. And different societies have dealt with this differently. But most societies in the Western world, most high-income OECD countries already have mechanisms in place to help people, for example, transition from, you know, manufacturing to the service sector. They have training programs. They have fairly generous social systems and so on. Now, of course, as I mentioned before, South Korea is a bit different in that respect. But most countries do have mechanisms in place already. And it's a question of whether you want to increase those or whether you want to leave them as is. And these are ultimately political decisions that have to be made.
Going back to perceptions and associations of income inequality, how much are income inequality issues connected with issues of upward mobility? So people are trying to go from lower to middle class or middle to upper middle class and then kind of move up the ladder. And so how much is that perception impacting or being a part of this income inequality conversation, whether in South Korea or whether in the other countries that you've looked at?
I think this is a very interesting issue because if I look at the U.S., for instance, my understanding is that even though income inequality has been increasing in the U.S., social mobility has not changed. Upward social mobility has remained relatively constant. It hasn't changed that much. So there is a perception among some individuals that these two things are not related. I don't necessarily buy that argument because to the extent that income inequality is itself a reflection of inequality of opportunity, then it should logically lead to the conclusion that income inequality is actually preventing upward social mobility. So if you think about, just to give you a concrete example, if you think about people who live in poor neighborhoods, for instance, who have unequal access, or who do not have access to a good educational system, that, to me, is an inequality of opportunity that translates ultimately into an inequality of income. But that inequality of opportunity prevents that person from moving upwards socially. And we've seen that even in the Canadian context, which I'm a bit more familiar with, where it's been shown, for instance, that there's not a lot of intergenerational mobility. So if you're born into a household where incomes are low, it's actually very difficult for you to move out of it within one generation. So, you know, these things are related. I'm quite sure that if you were to be born in a poor family, the chances of you gravitating to a higher income family would be much less or much lower than someone who was born into a richer family or a richer neighborhood and so on. So these things certainly matter. And we have these problems in Canada. We have these problems in the U.S. We know where they are. We know, for instance, that depending on where you're born, your location will actually be a huge factor in determining where you end up.
So one of the main kind of points and conclusions in your paper was the management is going to be the issue as you're going through these structural changes. I guess kind of one of the first decisions these policy makers have to make is the level of income inequality that they're comfortable with. What are some other things that you think they're going to have to manage and go through as they think about the changes and fluctuation in income inequality in the country?
In the South Korean case, I think there really needs to be a serious thinking about what the future of the manufacturing sector and the future of the service sector will look like. To me, it's going beyond the evolution of income inequality and looking at the structural changes. So we know, for example, that Korea still has a very highly productive, efficient manufacturing sector that's driving a lot of its growth.
Right.
But clearly, if you look at the employment shares in that sector over time, it's declining. It's still a very productive sector. And maybe the reason why it's employing less and less people is largely a reflection of that high productivity. It's being more automated. There's fewer people who are needed. So I think the Korean society and policymakers and the government need to really look at this issue and think about, okay, what's going to happen next over the next 10 to 15 years? If this process continues and we have more and more people now who are working in what is now a more service-oriented economy, then what kind of jobs are these people going to need? What kind of education, for instance, will these people need? How are we going to make sure that they can move up the so-called value chain? Are they going to produce, for instance, services that are sought by not only Koreans, but also people outside of Korea? What are the export possibilities for some of the services? And these are very important issues, because as long as these structural shifts continue, and as long as you have an economy that is going to be more and more driven by the service sector, as in the case of many of the high-income OECD countries, then these are issues that need to be addressed. So when I say managing structural pressures, it's really thinking about these bigger questions. What kind of society are we looking at over the next 10, 15 years? What do we do with all of these young, highly educated people, for instance, who graduate from university? Where do they end up getting jobs? Again, it's the same problem that we look at in the US and in the Canadian context. So there are similarities there. These are challenges that high-income countries are facing, and South Korea will not be an exception.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Sammy. This has been great. We appreciate you helping us focus on this issue a little bit and help policymakers kind of work through these issues and make these tough decisions and ask these tough questions. So thank you so much for joining us and talking with us on Korean Context.
Thank you.
Our guest today was Dr. Yagadeesan Sammy, Associate Professor at Carleton University in Ottawa, Canada. Thank you so much for listening to KEI's Korean Context podcast, and we hope you will listen again next time.